broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis Van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio is Joel Hewish, Chief Investments Officer.
Morning, Louis. Morning, listeners.
Good
morning, Brett.
And Brett Dickinson.
Hey, guys. Property. Yes, good morning. Very good.
And special guest star today, Marshall Condon, the co-founder of WeFund. Hello, Marshall.
Hey, guys. How are you going?
Morning.
Great to have you here, Marshall.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So welcome aboard. You're making a guest appearance for us today to tell us a bit more about you and where you come from. So, Marshall, why don't we just kick in straight with you and tell us a bit about your background.
It's a pretty boring one. It's been finance for the last 12 years.
Finance. Surprising that we have a finance person on the finance podcast.
Haven't heard that one before.
Mate, that's not boring.
Boring.
Yes. That's really exciting.
No, look, I started my kind of finance career when I was 18. I actually moved here from the country and the whole aim was trying to be the next Tom Petrosky and get into the investment banking game.
And what happened? You didn't go through puberty?
I couldn't get the ponytail going, unfortunately.
That's right.
It's been a goal of mine for a while to get the ponytail, but I don't think my missus will be too happy
with it. What about the beard, though? What happened to the beard?
Yeah. I've been growing this since I was 12, so this is the best I've got, boys. I came down here to get in the finance game and found myself falling into a role as a mortgage broker when I was about 18. So as a group of guys that I was introduced to at a local footy club and they took a punt on me and I kicked off when I was 18. Did uni by correspondence and then kind of went into the bank a few years later. Cut my teeth there learning risk and credit and the banking side of things. And then was able to get the opportunity to start my business about 7 years ago. So that business was a debt advisor as well as a mortgage broking business as well. And that's kind of helped kind of gather the skills and contacts we've kind of built here for WeFund, which is what we kind of launched about 6 or 7 weeks ago.
Oh, that recent.
Yeah. It's been a long time in the making, I suppose. Like the tech piece has taken a while and it's something we've had to get patient with in terms of the timing and cost of getting these things up and running. But at the same time, we wanted to deliver something to the market that was going to really help out and be useful. So the first iteration that we've launched about 6 weeks ago so far has been pretty positive. We've really been smashed, to be honest. We kind of need to keep up and make sure we get on top of the inquiries coming through. But the space we're kind of operating is a new space in a way and it's quite there's a big need for it given where the current banking environment is. So essentially we operate in the non-bank space. So if a developer is looking to finance a project and the bank says no, they can come to us. We basically built a platform where they can submit their application online. We get that information, assess it, review it, and then structure it in a way. We send it out to our lenders we have on panel. They'll then review that application online and then submit offers from there. So we're able to basically use the technology to really speed up the process of gathering the data we need to present a transaction to lenders to get the best possible outcome.
So it sounds like something that has been a very hands-on process for the people involved. But now you put tech in the background, and tech is literally in the background with us today. His name's Richard, and he's not even on this podcast. He's just watching The Observer. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Pretty good,
mate. Hey.
Yeah, he's Irish, so we had either an Irish person or a mumbler, and so that was me, and I drive through the short straw, so you've got me instead.
All right, Marshall, the mumbler. Very good.
Well, as long as you throw in a few profanities, then you're part of the team.
Yeah. They may slip.
So, Marshall, what's the essential problem that WeFund is solving?
Yeah, so for us, we've been in this industry for a while, and what we saw was the non-banking space, given it's so new, a lot of people, when they get turned away from the bank, just don't know where to go and who to go to. And in this space, there's been, there's a variety of different types of lenders there. There's kind of family office type of private lenders, all the way up to kind of institutional lenders. So depending on your size, your project, and what your background is, usually you could get it done through the banks, and the banks have been doing it for a long time, and they've had a large market share. But the last couple of years, it's obviously becoming incredibly difficult to get money out of the banks, and they've tightened up policy, and it is hard for developers to get money, especially from, you know, a land purchase on an acquisition point of view. So a lot of these guys would then get turned away and they're not knowing where to go. So, and who to trust, because in this space, it's still unregulated. It is still very much, you know, some people can get taken advantage of. Mm. So the issue is that trying to find a non-bank lender who can trust, who's going to come up with the money, but also make sure that their terms and conditions are also appropriate, and you get through the development and you finish it, and when you pay back, everyone's square.
Yeah.
You know, most people when we deal with them usually have a horror story from dealing with non-bank lending already, or have a negative experience with dealing in the private space. So our aim really is to kind of bring some transparency into this space and provide that really, I suppose, a bit more of a translation between that private lender and what they're after to the borrower, so they know what to expect up front and they know what to do. And also, you know, so they can get through their project and get to the end.
Yeah. So I'm interpreting that as a new way to really be in an old space.
Correct.
Because lending has been around for hundreds of years and it didn't start with banks. Banks came after lending, and the regulation exists in that space, but people have always lent money to each other.
Yeah.
And I think before this, it's if you think of a law firm who provides debt for projects because they've got a pool of money, or like you say, private family offices, or anyone with a pool of money, or even loan sharks and debt collectors.
Yep.
Same principle.
Yep.
But it sounds like you're specialised in the property development space. Is that correct?
So we call it debt advisor as well. So when a developer sits through a project, we'll look at the project and see what the best way to finance it is. So if that is going through to a senior lender and maybe putting some mezz in there, that's what we'll say. But if there's a stretch position or there's a non-bank position that allows less pre-sales or less equity, we'll put that position forward as well, so the developer can really understand what's going to be the best outcome for that project.
So Marshall, for the benefit of a lot of our listeners who are not experienced in the space of lending, maybe you could explain the different forms of lending that that developers may actually take advantage of.
Yep.
So you're going right from your first mortgage all the way through to your mezz, and now I believe there's some new innovative mix types of loans as well.
Yeah, so the first and then the majority of what people will always take up is a first mortgage. So that's going to your bank or a lender, and they give them the first mortgage, and they'll lend up to a certain LVR and a certain maybe percentage of costs. If you then want to then put some more debt into there, you can then do a mezzanine or a second mortgage behind that. That'll allow you to borrow on top of the first mortgage and put less equity in. They come at higher rates, so you are paying more for it. And then there's another layer again, which is called pref equity. So there's other lenders that will do some preferential equity, which essentially sits then on top of your mezz. And basically, in terms of how it works when you're getting paid back, is your equity will go in first. You put your pref in, your mezz, then the senior. But on the way back out, when everything gets sold and the money comes back, the senior gets paid back, then the second, then the pref, then the equity. So,
and each tier gets paid back fully with their interest prior to the other one.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. So first being first, second, then the pref, and then the equity from there. So
which is why your first mortgage is usually at a lower interest rate.
Correct.
Because they get their money first, lower risk.
Lower risk.
Second is higher, and then third is higher again.
Exactly right.
So for non-bank lenders, what are they typically seeking on a first mortgage in terms of their rate of return that they're looking for, and then what are the sort of differences as you go down the capital structure?
Yeah, it does vary based on the size of the deal and the type of deal where it is. It is still very much case by case. Like a lot of these lenders don't really have rate cards, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
They'll rate for risk per transaction. So that could start from, so in the lower end, you know, you might be around eights and nines for a first mortgage.
Yep.
But as you go up, say, you know, $50 million plus, you start going to institutional lenders, they'll then lend on a margin plus a line fee on top of cost of funds. So it can be quite cheap. So they are actually really competitive at the moment and challenging the banks, because some of these guys in institutional space, say $50 million plus, will require less pre-sales than the bank. So the bank will want 100% debt cover through pre-sales. These guys will maybe let you start at 70 or 80. So it, in terms of, you know, when you're looking at the deal itself and return on equity and getting out of a project quicker, if you can get in quicker, 6 months, 12 months sooner, and get out quicker, then your return on equity should be better. So you might be paying marginally more on your interest rate, but when you look at your equation on the bottom line of my money going in and my money coming back out, most of the time it's a better option.
And what about the volume of projects on the market right now? We went through the heady days between sort of 2011 through to 2017. What are you seeing in the space right now in terms of projects coming to market and needing funding?
The last 12 months has been incredibly difficult, and probably 18 months really for developers. We haven't seen a lot of bigger projects being launched, and it'd be a huge risk for developers to launch a, say, 100, 150 plus project at the moment.
This is in terms of apartment size.
Apartment sizes, yep. Yeah. So, and that's actually come off the back of the lack of credit supply on the home loan side. Mm-hmm. So it's been very hard for purchasers to get finance to purchase these apartments. And that then means there's less demand for the sales.
And this is largely because the banks are asking for lower LVRs on apartments and off the plan.
Not necessarily. It's more from changes about 3 to 4 years ago from APRA coming into the home loan lenders and really sharpening their policies up. So 3 or 4 years ago, they brought in the assessment rate of the 7.25% on all debts.
Yeah.
No interest only loans being assessed over 25 years than 30.
Yeah.
So a lot of these changes really crippled the borrowing capacity of a lot of people, especially who had existing debt. And so for a purchaser to go out and try and buy an investment apartment to add into their portfolio, they already had existing home loan debt, it was quite hard for them to do so. You know, they most of the time, you know, we were in the home loan space before, we'd review a current client situation and we couldn't show they could afford their current debt, let alone anything else based on the changes that had gone through. So that really strangled that demand, I suppose, for apartments in the investment space. And that's what's seen with why people aren't launching projects at the moment, because the sales just aren't there. The demand for apartments aren't there because people can't get the money to purchase them.
Well, it would be that in combination with the offshore buyer disappearing too.
That as well, yeah.
That drove a lot of the demand earlier.
That was a huge thing. So when all the major banks pulled out of foreign lending or lending to foreigners, that dropped off a cliff really quick.
Right.
So that created a huge void for the very largest apartments, like in the CBD when there's 300-400 plus apartments. The sales strategy for those was offshore first and then go onshore, and that's how you'd get them up and out. But there just isn't that demand at all from overseas at the moment. But from what I'm hearing, though, it is coming back. And there's different lending solutions that are in the non-bank space for these types of purchases, but not quite as near as demand as it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Right, right. So we have the senior lender or the first mortgage, and you're sort of looking at rates anywhere between. So you were saying on the bigger deals, you could get probably around sixes plus a line fee, maybe of 1 or 2% on top of that.
Oh, even less. So,
even less. Yeah.
So some at the moment are like now you. 5%.
5%.
Including line fee.
Including the line fee.
Yeah.
And most of the time, the lender who was providing that would want 100% or 80% debt coverage.
Well, in this particular instance, they only require 70.
Okay. So for the listeners, what that basically means is that if you've got $20 million borrowings on a project, the bank or the lender would want you to at least have pre-sold 70 to 80% of the value of that debt in order for them to feel comfortable to lend to you.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So they take the view that, look, we will let you start with less pre-sales, but we want to get an idea of the strategy and that you are going to hit 100% over time.
Yep.
So it's not in terms of the risk side of things. They are covering themselves off to make sure they get to the end and they can get paid back.
Yep.
So there is still other conditions in there to make sure that the building will get sold and they get paid back, but it allows the developer to start now. And usually what happens is when the construction starts, that's when more demand comes for the project because people know it's going to go up. So
Correct. It
helps the sales along as well.
And so then you're looking at the next tier, so you're the second mortgage, which basically means that you fall in behind the first mortgage and all of their repayment and principal of interest. What sort of interest rates are we looking at there?
Yeah, so again, in the larger space, they start at about 12%.
And that's, 12%.
And that's in the $4 or $5 million plus, and that's if you still have coverage from pre-sales.
Yep.
Without, it's 15.
Yep.
And in the small space, can be up to like 24.
Percent.
Mm.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So the differences are dramatic.
Yeah. So
and then you get to mezzanine, which generally has no mortgage that covers it, or sometimes mezzanine.
Well, mezzanine is second.
That's second. Okay.
They're interchangeable.
Yep.
The pref, then that's no really pre-sales. It's a much larger return.
Right.
You're looking at 20 plus there for from a pref point of view.
Yes.
Because they're taking Their money's going in fairly soon, so they're taking the permit, sales, construction, and settlement risk on.
And it's not secured by any.
There's no security generally, and then they obviously the second last get paid back. So
they do
get a higher return, but they're taking on almost the full risk of the project.
Sure. Okay. So just so I'm clear, so mezzanine is generally considered the second mortgage. Is that
yep.
okay? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, okay.
Marshall, a lot of what you just mentioned there was from the construction side of things.
Yep.
What about land banking, the initial acquisition of the site?
Yeah.
Are the lenders at the same rates and same LVRs?
Yeah, they vary, but very similar. So, look, that's at the moment, the majority of their stuff is the land banking side because banks just aren't doing any land funding. If you're pre-permit and you have a development site, banks just aren't touching it. So, we have funders who will go up to 65% on land banking, and their rates will start again from anywhere from 7.5% up to 9-10%. Mm-hmm. And it allows a developer to get in, get their permit, and then potentially, get a bank on board after they got their permit sales, then go from there. But it's a more expensive solution than bank right now, but it allows developers keep rolling their projects over rather than sitting on them and going stale. So,
and what about experience? So if you're a listener out there and you're thinking, you wouldn't mind getting into starting to do your own developments, what type of experience are the lenders looking for as part of your team?
Yep, because most of these lenders are an asset lender and also a sponsor lender, really, because they're not asking for financials and serviceability.
So just explain that, asset and sponsor lender.
So the way the banks look at most transactions is they want to know that you can pay it back through income most of the time, or they want to see your income that you can service the debt. So if you're getting a debt of $2 million, they want to know that you've got enough income to pay that debt down.
Typical mortgage, that type of stuff.
Yep. And the bank's second exit is, if you can't pay, then we'll sell the asset. The non-bank lenders look at the asset first and say, well, do I like the asset? If something goes wrong, can I sell it and get my money back? And secondary is, if you have income, even better.
Yep.
So given they're looking at it that way as well, they want to make sure that the sponsor they're also lending to will play ball with them if something goes wrong too. Mm. So experience of the sponsor definitely is still a big thing for these guys.
Yep.
If you don't have a lot of experience, it's definitely harder to present the transactions to lenders to get them comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It'll probably mean you'll have a higher rate because it is higher risk for them because it's the first time you're doing it.
Sure.
So it does still carry a lot of weight and probably as much as a bank would also take. But they're not asking for financials and serviceability and those sort of things. So on a 2-3 townhouse project, if it's your first project, it's not going to be a big issue because it's deemed pretty small for development.
Sure.
So you'd be able to get away with not a lot of experience if you've got a good builder, you've got a fixed price building contract, and you can kind of mitigate those sort of things.
Yeah.
Because everyone's got to start somewhere, and a lot of these lenders know that as well. There's a few lenders who's kind of, they specialize in that space. They like the 2-4 townhouse projects that they can know they can turn around quickly if they trust the builder and they know the builder will deliver, then they'll go from there. But
sure.
The biggest stuff, definitely experience is a huge thing.
Yep.
And on the size of those projects, you said some of the smaller ones, 2-3 dwellings, are they still wanting a QS in between them on that smaller size? Because that becomes a bit of a burden.
No, not on the 2-3. They usually will rely on the valuation up front, and they might then get the value to go out at different stages.
Yeah.
If it's a fixed price contract over 5 progressive draws, they'll probably just send the value out at those 5 stages.
Yeah.
And that's just to make sure that the money they've given to the builder goes in the project. So,
yeah.
there's a lot of that's happened before and it hasn't.
But they'd still have a claims process that the project manager or someone would go
Correct.
Through.
Yeah, so the builder still sees a claim and the bank will then get the value out there and go from there. So it's QS in a way, but through a valuer rather than a QS.
Yeah.
So Marshall, arranging the finance for these types of projects is your background.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to WeFund, what did that process look like?
So the process before was you'd meet a client, understand what they're looking to do, ask for a whole suite of information from them in terms of FISOs, sales schedules, building contracts, getting all that data.
So understand the project thoroughly.
Yep. They'd email it all through to you in a bunch of documents with a few paragraphs. I'll then go away, put that into an IM, structure it all up, present it away to the lenders. So basically when I was at the bank, we used to have to do a credit paper. And that credit paper would nut off on basically 5 key kind of topics we need to make sure we mitigate. I'd use that same structure in my IMs to provide back to the banks because I knew that's basically they could copy paste this and put their own credit papers.
And just once again, IMs are memorandum.
Yep.
It's an offer document that rather than a prospectus or a product disclosure statement for retail investors, it's an offer document for more wholesale institutional investors.
Yep.
So you as the arranger of the loan would have to prepare that for your client.
Yep.
And then send it manually to each
So the process bank. We'd email who we knew who would look at it, and then we'd call them up, say, have you got it? Have you read it? When can you come back to me? Let me know. And you'd do that. We'd probably only send it out to a handful of lenders. So, you know, we do have a lot of lenders we deal with, but the our kind of point of difference is we don't send it out to the market. We're not trying to be a marketplace and send it to all 47 lenders that we deal with. Because number one, lenders all have their own niches about what deals they will look at and not look at. So we don't want to waste their time in terms of sending them deals they're not going to look at. But also, it's actually a really bad look for the deal. When a deal gets, it is actually a very small marketplace in this non-bank space. And non-bank lenders will know if someone, if the whole market's seen a deal and it gets a bad smell if it looks like it's been shopped around the market. So we'll only choose a handful of lenders we know who will sit, go with them and work with them in terms of getting their offers back. And we're transparent with those lenders as well to say, we've gone to a couple of lenders. They know our job is to make sure we get the right deal. They'll then come back to us with their terms. So previously we'd have to call around, have a chat to them, have a discussion. Then they would then send back their term sheets. Then we'd put together that we'd go through that term sheet, structure all that, put into a mandate document, present that back to the client. So the way we do it now is the data that comes in. So there's a portal for borrowers to actually enter all that data in our portal, upload all their documents into our portal. We'll then use that data and then structure it in our way in online into our own portal, which then goes out to the lenders we select. So a lender that we select will get an email saying there's a new deal. They log in, see all the transaction information, all the documentation, and there's an option there for them to offer a term sheet on the spot. So they can basically drag and drop their PDF in there. We receive that, comes through to our portal. Again, we then go through that, put it into our mandate and go from there. So it saves us a bucket load of time, obviously, doing that. So we can turn things around much quicker because we're getting the same piece of data in, same piece of data out. Mm. Means we can get offers back quicker as well because we're providing a way to lenders that they can basically make a decision whether they're in or out because it's got enough information there for them to do so. So our kind of our value proposition is fast and transparency. We want to provide fast solutions and provide that transparency because some of these term sheets are some of them are comical in the way that they kind of structure their rates and costs. There's one particular lender that will give you an interest rate and then they've got a management fee built in as well, but it's actually written in there that the management fee is 25% of the interest per month. But that's not in numbers, it's in words. So it's a paragraph you've got to read, then do your own calculation and work out what your true cost is. So
buyer beware.
Yeah, and a lot of people play those little games there and people don't realise until the end, shivers, there's another 2.5% on my loan here. I thought it was an 8% rate, that's what you told me. It's actually 10.5%. So yeah, we will try and we'll extract all the information, provide it up front to the borrower, say this is actually what you're being charged, and that's what this offer looks like.
So I guess there's an amount of security there because you're making sure that the data and the terms is all in the same format.
Yep.
And very comparable between the different offers.
Yep.
Firstly, for the borrower going to the lenders, and then the lenders offering them their deals.
Yeah, exactly right.
So it's a really efficient communication platform.
Yeah.
So under the old method, what would be the turnaround time to go from a client query to then having offers on the table?
Yeah, so the IM process was the large process. That took a lot of time, getting all that data and putting it all together to sending it out.
Yep.
We kind of write our lenders to get it back within probably 3 to 4 days if we could.
Yep.
The now we can kind of turn things around within 24, 48 hours and we expect 24, 48 hours response from our lenders as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've cut that time process in half at the moment.
Yep.
But with Rich and the technology, we're kind of continuing to build, we see that coming down again. By extracting data from different data sources with title searches, company searches, those sort of things, providing those cylinders up front again just so that they have less DD, everything's provided, they can make quicker decisions and turn things around as well.
Yeah, great. So less time frame and a greater security
from
what your platform is delivering.
Yep.
Fantastic.
And so you as a business, how do you plan to grow and expand?
Borrowers obviously are our direct clients who we're out there to assist, but in this space, a lot of borrowers already have relationships with brokers. Mm-hmm. And being a broker myself, I understand that. So we're out there to help brokers as well get access to our panel for their clients as well. So we have two different ways. So we call them introducers, so they can also log into our platform and have their own portal and submit all their transactions through their portal, which will then you know, be tagged as their clients. Mm-hmm. The broker then essentially becomes our client, and we'll deal with the broker, help them understand the term sheets, present to their clients, so their clients then understand what's happening as well.
So this could be a really great way for brokers who are in the industry who haven't sort of played in this space to actually start to get access to these types of deals.
Yeah, so it solves a problem as well for the aggregators who kind of sit as like the licensee companies can get access to now. For brokers who haven't dealt in the commercial space or non-bank space, you know, they basically get access to our kind of a proven 47 lenders that we're dealing with. So they're able to get access to solutions to their clients that they may not know themselves. So rather than maybe turn down a transaction and say, we can't help, it's not our expertise, they can maybe have a look at it, get some data, send through to us, we can help them structure it up and get a solution for their client. So helps their relationship, I suppose, with their client to be more sticky, because, you know, the risk for them is, if their client goes somewhere else and gets it through somewhere else, then there's potentially the opens the door for the broker to lose that relationship. Mm.
So just on that, how do you guys make money?
So in this space, it's all a fee for service. So
fee for service, right.
We charge a fee to the client for the service, mm-hmm. and that gets paid at settlements essentially. So
in this instance, if you're dealing with a broker, all of those brokers out there, they still get entitled to their brokerage.
Yeah, so we will split that fee with the broker. So if it's been introduced through a broker and they do the legwork in terms of getting the information from the client, then we split it with the broker as well. So rather than, you know, we're definitely not in the space of we charge a fee, the broker charges a fee, and the client ends up paying double. So we split that fee with the broker. So rather than the client paying a fee to their broker and the fee to us, and then the fee being double, we just don't think that's necessary or competitive. So we'll split our fee with the broker to make sure the client's still getting something competitive.
Yep. And so going forward, what sort of trends are you starting to see right now? Are you starting to see, I mean, you spoke previously that the big end of the market, the 150 apartment projects and greater are pretty much dead at this point in time. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, they've struggled over the last 12 months, but some guys who've kind of been able to get through it, there are good funding options for them to be able to kick off. So, you know, I think from speaking with people, next year there should be a fair few more launches in this space because people know they can get access to different lending products now.
Sure.
Because the lending side was also an issue for some developers of knowing where to go to get money to get the project out of the ground outside of just the sales.
And are you seeing developers coming back to the market? They might have been sitting on projects that they would have ordinarily brought to the market. Are they starting to bring those projects to market now, or is it still a bit slow at this stage?
Yeah, there's definitely the developers that have been around for a long time who have got pipeline who will continue to develop through. We're probably seeing less of maybe the speculators trying to get in and get a quick development out of the ground and out again because it is quite difficult.
Yeah.
You know, really we've seen that, you know, revenue's dropped about 15% in terms of what people can sell their apartments for.
Yeah.
Construction prices have gone up between 10 and 15%. That's a moving target every day. But land prices haven't really changed in the site space. So when you look at a feasibility, it's very hard to get it to stack up right now unless you'd bought it previously and it's got some equity built in.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting 6 months to see what happens because a lot of these sites have been purchased that may not stack up, may come back on market. And there's plenty of guys who've been waiting to see what happens over these next 6 months and do have capital to maybe pounce on some of these sites. So I'm hoping next year there's definitely more activity, and I think there will be, just given where the market is.
So the activity is more likely to be in the secondary transfer of sites from one party to another rather than a lot more new development coming on.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so there's still the prospect that with this oversupply in apartments that was around 3-4 years ago, that might start to sort of come back into balance a bit.
Yeah, look, so I think that's going to be an undersupply very shortly given that the lack of projects coming on, especially in the larger side of things. So when you look at the amount of permits that were approved, say, 4 years ago compared to now, it's kind of dropped off a cliff completely. So that investor type of product, there's what we're hearing from the channels is there's more demand for that now. Investors still want a place to put money, and given where the cash rate is, property still is a safe bet for them. So developers who had sites who want to get in that space, it's a good time for them because, you know, lending's become a little bit easier as well from the investor point of view. So that allows people to then maybe go out and get an investment property now. So that things are changing a little bit, but it's still a bit of a wait and see because, you know, with these sites coming back on the market on the secondary purchase, you know, it does create a bit of a angst potentially in the market about things aren't as good as they thought with these sales coming through. So we'll see what happens. The good developers will continue to develop, and they've developed through the GFC. May drop off a few others that weren't potentially more in there.
Marginal developers.
Yeah. Yep. And then, you know, there'll definitely be more projects going up. But we've seen a shift from, say, apartments to hotels to commercial now. Commercial is the new thing. Yeah. A lot of people wanting to do office space now rather than residential apartments.
Yep.
And again, that's just because those developers will pivot. They'll change their view. They'll buy certain sites. Childcare is another one as well.
Adapt to the market, what the market's taking at that time.
Yep. Yep. So they'll find sites based on what the demand is for the upside, I suppose.
We saw that with 555 Collins Street just change hands. Originally, that was going to be luxury apartments, and then that has now been sold on to Charter Hall, who are going to convert that into office building now.
Yeah. Well, there was actually a very big demand for office. And if you look at the office vacancy rates over the last few years, especially in CBD, it was very hard to find space.
Yeah.
And in the city fringes as well, it's almost impossible. So, you know, we have offices in Cremorne, and in that area, it's gone ballistic. You know, your square meter rates there are probably more expensive now than top street or Collins Street. So, it's that's why the office space is the new kind of flavor of the month at the moment. There's good returns there if you can find a good site.
We've spent a bit of time out in Cremorne recently, and it feels like it's a real sort of hub of activity. Feels like there's a lot going on out there.
Yeah, so Seek just have their building that they're constructing there. I heard as well just recently BHP are moving there. Mm. You've got Myob moving there. You've already got realestate.com and a bunch of other kind of tech type of companies as well. So, yeah, it's a changing place at the moment.
Yeah, I always thought of Cremorne as a bit of a technology startup precinct. Mm. And now it seems to be maturing.
Yeah. Yep. No, we love the space. It's good.
Yeah.
And what's a lot of people still don't know where Cremorne is.
No. Right next to Richmond.
You're exactly right. So it's basically Richmond. But it's a good space.
Yeah. Very good.
Very good. Well, Marshall, thank you very much for being with us giving us such a detailed overview of what you do and the market around that. We'll be back after this break.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640. Or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back. Joel, let's kick over to you. And what do you have us?
What do you have us?
Let me try again.
Okay.
And welcome back. Joel, let's kick over to you. What do you have for us this week?
Well, have you guys ever felt like you just work and work and work and at the end of the day that after taxes, there's nothing ever left?
God, yes.
Well, it turns out that here in Australia, taxes on income and profits are actually the second highest in the world.
Wow.
In terms of the way that our federal government derives its tax revenue, it's a very narrow focus and heavily reliant on income taxes, taxes on profits, and also taxes on real estate. In actual fact, if we have a look at the average for the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the average take or the average revenue generation that comes from income taxes and profits across those countries is around about 34%. So the revenue that governments on average in the OECD generate from taxes come from income and profits. Represents about 34% of their total income tax take. Here in Australia, it's at 58.8%.
Right.
And we are just behind Denmark, which is actually a very well-known social welfare state. You get, and Iceland, which is, and Switzerland, well, not so much Switzerland, but Iceland, where you've got this welfare state, which is very much around high taxes and lots of investment in public sector services. But for Australia, which I don't believe we consider ourselves that type of country, Yes, it is a very high impost on the personal incomes that we generate. Okay. So a lot of discussion around how the federal government might broaden its tax base and hopefully stimulate what is a bit of a lagging economy at the moment, or a meandering economy. And perhaps there needs to be a look at from federal government on both sides of the of politics in terms of how we might be able to remove some of that burden, encourage the consumer to go out there and spend again, and maybe this is the first part that they need to have a look at. Mm. There needs to be a consideration as to how that they look at perhaps GST, how that is imposed. I believe that there's only around about 60% of all goods and services actually have GST actually put on it.
Right.
And that was thanks to the Democrats back in the day when when we were bringing in the GST, they had this great idea that, no, we're going to carve out health services and food and all this other stuff.
Essential items, yeah.
Essential items, exactly. Yep.
The problem when the GST was introduced, well, the GST was a solution because it being a consumption-based tax, as consumption increases, then the tax base increases. Mm. The problem was that since then, inflation has just been extremely low. And in the last 5 years, the Reserve Bank hasn't been able to get inflation up to its target, which means the price of goods and services is not increasing. And the biggest increase in goods and services is in healthcare, which is exempt from GST, and is education exempt from GST, like private school fees? Because, I mean, they're always going up.
Good question. And I'm not sure.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
But your basic items like bread, milk, eggs, your essential items, there's been price increases there as well. And again, it's not GST.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is interesting.
I think there's an argument to suggest that given that we have struggled for the best part of, well, it'd be 8 years now since the mining boom, there's probably an argument to suggest that we need to have a rethink about how our taxes are raised. Not so much whether or not the tax rate and the tax take is appropriate, but where it's coming from. Obviously, we're seeing some pressure on retail sales. We're seeing declines or a weakness in consumption. And if we get this, if we are having to have any chance of getting this economy back into a trend growth rate, then we need to perhaps have a look at how we encourage those sectors that are lagging a little bit. Mm. Now, I've also spoken about my view and around how we see the stock market performing over the next 12 months. In fact, we're actually quite positive. Generally, we have suggested that when you have lower interest rates, you've got lack of financial stress, you have an investment sentiment that is quite cautious and concerned. You have corporate profits that are doing reasonably okay. And an economy that is not overheating, but not in the trough either. That's usually actually pretty good environment for asset prices to continue to rise. Well, one of the additional factors that is now weighing into that is that in over the year of 2019, we've actually seen cash balances, so money in money market accounts, money going into bonds, short-term treasuries, these types of safe haven assets. Over the last 12 months, cash outflows out of equities and into cash has actually been at the highest levels since 2009. So the jump in cash held has been higher than what we saw in the global financial crisis. Now, in order to see equity prices rise, you would typically need to see cash coming back into equities. Well, interestingly enough, the last two times that we have seen such a jump in cash happened in 2016 and 2011. And the subsequent 12 months after that led to price returns of 20% or greater. Mm. So we're at an interesting point where all of this cash over the last 12 months has been pulled out of the market. But now with interest rates being lowered and interest rate returns being depressed, in the last 5 weeks alone, we have actually seen that trend reverse, and that has actually coincided with the S&P 500 breaking out to a new all-time high and the ASX 200 also breaking out to a new all-time high as well. But there's still a shit ton of cash to come back in.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for where is the likely buying power going to come from to see equity prices rise over the next 12 months, look no further than the high levels of cash sitting on the sidelines that now appear to be trying to find a home back in the equity market.
Right. Well, that's positive signs for sure. Absolutely.
And Louis just did some research. So, yeah, tuition fees, school fees, GST free.
There you go.
There you go.
Thank you, Brett. Hmm. I'm right again. How about that?
Yeah.
Tick for Louis. Brett, are you talking about asset prices as well?
Nope. Well, I guess I am. I'm just going to quickly touch on CoreLogic's November data.
Okay.
So the way they word this, I'm not in total agreement with. They're saying that Australia's housing market is now 5 months into its recovery. Now, a lot of they base it because they're just looking at the data across the whole market. We know that's not the reality. The market's not one market. You've got different divisions of the market in different geographic locations. But And the bulk of the data that they're always averaging out is, you know, weighted around Melbourne and Sydney house prices. But even so, if we take the data for what it is, they're saying that the national index recorded an increase of 1.7% for the month of November, which overall across all dwelling values says that Australia's average dwelling price is now 0.1% above where it was 12 months ago. Okay. So it means, you know, on average, our house prices are back to where they were 12 months ago when the declines were in effect.
Right. So they've dipped and then we've recovered the dip.
Yeah, dipped and we've recovered. Yeah. So I just thought it was interesting to say, hey, you know, when the decline started, we forecast a recovery would come. We're basically back level pegging with where we were a year ago.
Yeah.
So if you've been in the property market for that time, you've basically gone nowhere. But that doesn't mean that that's going to be the case going forward. We still think that, you know, the good properties in good areas are going to be good assets and will grow. But the challenge is finding those areas and finding the right properties is always going to be the battle. Of the capital cities, though, through November, they all showed increases in dwelling values everywhere other than Darwin.
Everywhere other than Darwin, rightio.
Okay. Mm.
Interesting, Marshall, you were talking before about the fact that you thought there was a chance that the apartment market could actually fall into undersupply in the not-too-distant future. That lines up, Brett, with the Charter-Kett-Kramer report that you discussed. Was it Charter-Kett-Kramer?
I can't think.
It might have been CBRE. I can't remember anyway. It was about three or four episodes ago where you released some information on one of the valuers or one of the big real estate companies that was suggesting that unless there is a dramatic turn in the supply response for new apartments, that in fact we could be going into a supply deficit.
Yeah, well, based on approvals, both dwelling approvals and building approvals, based and population growth. Yeah. You know, the supply demand ratio is going to be more in deficit at some point. It has to happen.
That hasn't changed too much at all. The population growth; those figures are still pretty strong. The obviously supply has dropped off, but even the established market, you know, those numbers don't really surprise you. But when you speak to kind of buyers' advocates and agents, there's no real stock coming on or no good stock either.
They're really frustrated at the moment. Yeah. And we've found the same, haven't we, Brett? I mean, just trying to find really, really good property that makes sense. It's hard to find.
And anytime anything good pops up, it goes for well overs because there's so much demand for that quality product.
And that's still the case even in this CoreLogic report here. Biggest struggle is, listing volumes are still significantly down.
That ties into the fact that if you don't need to sell, and right now there is, I mean, even though debt levels are high, there's no real financial stress because the interest rates are so damn low, that if you don't need to sell, then people aren't selling and they're hearing that the market is improving, so they're holding back and holding back. So who knows? Maybe we get that supply coming on mid to late next year and all of a sudden it gets back to a more normal transacting environment, but
I'm really curious about property statistics. I mean, the data's told us that we've had a reduction in value in the prices of sales and now an increase in value. I'm wondering how much of that reduction is a true market decline and how much of that reduction is because you've got lower quality stock on the market.
That's the biggest problem with the median price metric.
That's right. You don't know what the median price, what quality of property was sold in November versus October.
Yeah. And it's 23 bedroom houses in this suburb sold last month, 20 more this month, but they could be so different.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So if you've got crap stock being sold, and you've got an increase in the median price, well, that could be actually a lot more of a positive sign than what the numbers say.
Yeah.
But it's always anecdotal, isn't it?
Well, and this is where it's a flawed metric, but it's the only metric we can really use in this area. So I think you take that metric for what it is a sense of the market. But if you're looking to buy and you've got a particular area or type of property, I think you need to really be on the street and sussing out that particular market over a period of time to know.
Yeah. All right. We are going to take another break.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Who here's done an economics degree?
Nope.
Nope.
No, not an economics degree.
Yep.
Yep, there you go. Economic theory is, much of it is around supply and demand and what's the price of a good or service versus the price that people are willing to pay. And you've always got this nice chart of the vertical axis and the horizontal axis, and you've got this midpoint, and if you reach the right midpoint, well, then suddenly you'll have everyone buying and everyone selling, and it all works out nicely.
Equilibrium.
It's so clean.
In a perfect world.
Yeah. And that is traditional financial theory. And if you think of the stock market, the price of a share today is a perfect reflection of a true valuation of that company.
In terms of the supply and demand equilibrium?
Well, in traditional economic theory, the share price today is a perfect reflection of that business today.
Right.
In a true economic sense, it is worth exactly that, and everyone in the market is correct in the balance of their judgments. Behavioral finance is what I said I'd be talking about today, and I will. Behavioral finance is the theory that actually the market is made up of buyers and sellers, and all the participants are people with their own impressions, their own biases. Mm. And instead of the traditional economic theory being that everyone is rational and makes rational decisions based on all the available information, we know that everyone has biases in their opinions. Not everyone has the same information, and not everyone is rational about the way they use that information. Oh, you'd be surprised.
I know.
So I just wanted to point this out in behavioral finance theory and the fact that we as humans do actually make errors in our decision-making process. And this concept really grew some legs through the 90s when psychology around finance was starting to be integrated. So we're a couple of decades into this kind of thinking, and tech and the data mining that goes on is now a huge player in artificial intelligence and the predictive behaviors of humans. But the basic principles are that humans are subject to self-deception. We're subject to simplification. We're subject to emotions in our decision-making, and we're subject to social influence. And so we come across the top 10 factors in behavioral finance biases is that we have overconfidence or just an illusion of control. And you see this at the casino all the time. Oh, it was red three times in a row. I reckon it's going to be red again. It's a high probability of being red.
Yep, on a 50-50 probability.
Self-attribution bias. You've got hindsight bias. So, I was right about that coming up red again. I'm so good at playing roulette. You've got confirmation bias, where when we look at information, we don't assess it rationally. We place a higher value on new information which supports our existing belief, and a lower value on information which is against our existing belief, and all kinds of things. So we put in false narratives and false stories to support our views. We frame things in the right ways. We are anchored to the wrong things. We have a herd mentality. I'm going to focus on the last two. We have a herd mentality and we have loss aversion. Mm-hmm. So two things. So when prices are increasing, people want to jump on board.
Yes.
Following that herd mentality. So, oh, everyone else is buying, I'm going to jump on. Oh, everyone else is selling, I'm going to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that mentality leads to lots of people joining at the end of the cycle, right when it turns.
And this is why trends actually work. Trend following is actually a very prudent method of investment selection, as a part of investment selection.
Mm, that's right. You can actually play on the behavior of the market, and you can see it, particularly with share markets, because you do have so much data and volume, and you can see the psychology of markets playing in that share price as it squiggles up and down. It actually means something. And the other one is the loss aversion problem.
Mm-hmm.
So as an investor, if you get into an investment and then it goes up in value, let's say you get a 10% gain, what is there a greater tendency to do? There's a greater tendency to say, yes, I won. I'm going to sell out and I'm going to make my 10% profit. Excellent. Now, if you lose 10% on an investment, what is there a tendency to do more often?
Hold,
correct. And that's where all of our biases kick in. Oh, yeah, it's fallen 10%, but there's an excuse for it. I still have my original theory. I have my confirmation bias and all these things which lead me to, no, I'm just going to hold on and see what happens from here. And then a 10% loss can become a 20% loss. And it's this psychology that leads to people tending to sell their winners early and hold on to their losers too long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been well known in markets for a long time. So I wanted to bring that to our the attention of our listeners. And any basic reading of behavioral finance, there's ways to overcome it. And the number one way to overcome our own biases is to focus on the process. Have a process of investing or have a process of making investments. And this kind of goes for anything in life. It's not just finance. If you've got a process around the way that you assess things one way or the other, even if your process is an emotional check or a logic check, you can still assess these things. And that leads to better decisions being made based on data.
Absolutely. I mean, it's essentially what we do when we come down to selecting investments, both in the real estate market and the stock market. We take out the emotion and we focus on the facts. And one of the great ways to be able to do that is having our criteria mapped out and just running through the checklist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and sticking to it.
And sticking to it, yeah.
So for people looking to do their own investing, that's really the thing to work out first. What is your method? What are you going to do in your research that gets you to the final buying decision?
Mm.
Or if you're going to use experts to do it for you, what is their process? You got to understand the process.
All very right. Good.
And that's me for the day.
Okay.
Very good.
Let's move on to the next topic.
Oh, next section. Well, unfortunately, technical issues today. We don't have
the intro
music. Sorry, guys.
Come on, man.
But that doesn't mean we don't have some things to talk about then.
The ball was on the line. What have you got?
Okay. Well, I think we haven't aired an episode since Tesla launched their Cybertruck.
No, we haven't.
No, so no. we've always had a bit of a soft spot for Tesla and what they're about. And this was another one for them where, for those that didn't hear, the Cybertruck was supposedly this indestructible vehicle that Tesla launched. And at their launch, they decided to have one of their technicians or people there throw a metal ball at the windows to validate this.
Right, to prove how indestructible it is.
To prove how indestructible. Now, not only did the metal ball break one window, they repeated the exercise and it broke two windows. Elon, you've done it again.
Oh, my goodness. Can't be serious.
Well, how about we've spoken about Facebook and the poor year that Facebook have had. Well, look, we can't just keep piling a whole lot of shit on Facebook. Last week, I think when we came on, I spoke about us actually buying the stock.
Yes,
we're in it now. Let's say good things about Facebook.
Well, so we're in it. So let's talk our book a little bit. So a lady in Michigan just this week was using Facebook, just scrolling through, and it came up with a little bit of an announcement around a lottery winner in her district. And as she started scrolling through, she realized that the lottery ticket was also purchased at the place that she bought her lottery ticket. And before you know it, Facebook has helped her make $5.5 million.
Whoa.
By just simply scrolling through and meandering down that
brilliant
scroll
list. Wow. That's
so
amazing.
It's not all bad for Facebook.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
not.
Facebook. Maybe Mark Zuckerberg should mention that at the next congressional hearing.
Yeah, we help, we help people make 5.5 yeah. million.
Connecting all the dots. There was a new species of electric eel discovered recently.
Ooh, right.
That has the highest voltage shock in the world.
Ooh, where
it puts
is it?
Out, it's from the Amazon, and it puts out an 850-volt shock.
Holy Ooh. Shit. That's a lot.
So, of course, some of these have been captured and held in zoos across the world.
In Tesla.
Yeah. it's the power source for the Cybertruck.
Exactly. Engine of a Tesla. So in Tennessee, a zoo has got into the Christmas spirit by rigging electric nodes to the tank of the electric eel to power some Christmas lights.
And it's working.
And it's working.
Brilliant.
Wow, so every time the electric eel is searching for food and it sends out a little vault, it powers the Christmas lights for a little second. And
nice.
then it starts eating and it gets even more excited and you can see how excited this electric eel is from the Christmas lights.
I wonder what happens when you put a female in a male.
Yeah, how does
it? You got real sparks.
It blows the Christmas tree up.
There's a fire extinguisher nearby. Oh, very good. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us for another episode.
Thanks, Marshall.
Special guest star,
Marshall. Yeah, thanks, Marshall, for coming along. That was really great.
To learn more about it.
So where do they go for your business?
WeFund.com.au.
Simple.
Everything's online. You can simply sign up or there's a scenario there. You can contact one of us, whatever you prefer to do.
Great.
Sounds awesome. Good.
Thanks, Marshall. No, and thanks, listeners, for another week.